You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to NSLT, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. We continue our series on our rising energy demands brought on by the rapid development of AI and the need for data centers and more powerful and more energy-consuming computer tasks. And we don't even have quantum computing yet. The need for energy is rapidly shaping up to be one of the most important issues for national security. And one of the central questions is whether or not our grid is capable of supporting our energy needs. And if not, what could happen if it fails? On April 28th of 2025, the Iberian Peninsula went dark. Reuters reported that there was a blackout across most of Spain and Portugal, bringing those countries to a standstill. Trains and electric trams stopped. Hospitals were forced to suspend routine operations. More than 30,000 police officers were deployed in Spain alone just to keep the general order and prevent looting. Spain's prime minister said that in 5 seconds, 60% of national electrical demand was lost, and the country suffered a 15 gigawatt loss of generation. Now, I have no idea what that means, but we're going to have somebody explain it. The problem, as it turns out, was an issue with the grid. So tonight we invited Dr. Jonathan Snodgrass from Texas A&M, who probably understands the grid better than almost anyone in the country. So anyway, Dr. Snodgrass, hey, thank you so much for coming in. We're glad to have you.
I'm glad to be here.
We're going to get into your bio in a few minutes, but let's just start with the basics. You really are one of the experts, and you've been on NPR recently talking about this exact issue. Just explain to our listeners in simplistic terms, what is the grid?
Yes. So the electric grid is kind of a colloquial term that we use to describe a power system. Since this is a podcast, I can't show you the classic picture, but imagine that there's a picture up of a power plant and some big tall power lines and then some shorter power lines and then a house. So when we say the grid or the electric grid, usually what we're referring to is the wires that carry the electricity from the power plants, whether they're traditional nuclear, coal, natural gas, or more like newer sources like renewables, wind or solar, and carry those to the loads, whether that's our house or, you know, the computers that are powering this podcast, et cetera. Some people will refer to the grid as including the load and the generation. So it's a little bit nebulous.
Okay, because I'm imagining a network of wires. It sort of looks like one of those jungle gym things that you might see on a playground, and it's not exactly that. But who owns the grid and who is charged with keeping it running?
That's the exciting and slightly terrifying part about the United States, is that there is no central entity that owns the grid. In fact, there's actually thousands of entities that own little bits of the grid. Without going into all the details, there's three major kind of players in the electric grid. One is investor-owned utilities, and they're probably the biggest in terms of size. So, you know, being from Texas, we have CenterPoint, Oncor here in Texas. They're big ones. You know, if you're in the Midwest, Alliant or AEP. If you're in California, Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, San Diego Gas and Electric, or like Southern California Edison, Exelon. These are all examples of what we call investor-owned utilities. So they're publicly traded. They're on the stock market. They answer to the shareholders. They have, you know, boards, and they own physical assets, whether that's generation, transmission lines, distribution lines. And so when I say those two terms, transmission and distribution, picture in your mind, you're driving down the road and you see the really tall lines. It's like there's a steel tower, or it kind of looks like, we call it an H-frame, but it kind of looks like two poles with a wooden pole in between them. So those are transmission lines. Those are what we call high voltage. And then there's the distribution lines, which are what you'd see in your neighborhood, your typical single pole with the three wires or sometimes two wires on top. And those are what we call low voltage. I say low voltage in air quotes, because low voltage is around 34,000 volts. And the high voltage network is anywhere between, you know, 138,000 volts up to 765,000 volts. So if you're a computer person, you know, and you charge your phone with 5 volts DC, that's all super high voltage to most people. But for a power person or a grid person, anything below about 100,000 volts is considered, in quotes, low voltage.
Okay, so that makes me nervous when I hear it's such a decentralized, independently owned network. There's no entity that has complete stewardship and responsibility for the grid.
Well, I'm interrupting for a second there. Sorry. There are oversight bodies. So we're talking about physical ownership, like who actually owns the wires and the poles and the generators and the transmission lines. That's you know, thousands of entities. However, there is one central entity that is responsible for the reliability of the grid. It's called the North American Electric Reliability Council, or NERC. That is the one overarching entity that is responsible for making sure the grid is operated efficiently and reliably. Now, how the NERC standards get implemented is a lot more complicated because you have NERC, which has no enforcement mechanism. So that's why FERC exists, the Federal Energy Regulatory Committee, or Council, depending on who you ask. The NERC is more of a carrot, and then FERC is more of the stick. And so there is one entity, but if you talk about who physically owns the actual pieces of the hardware that make up the grid, there's thousands of different entities. So one is investor-owned utilities. Second one is municipals. So like LA Water and Power, that's one of the biggest municipal utilities. Like here in College Station, which is where I live, we have a little small municipal utility. And then there's also what's called co-ops. So, you know, you think REI types co-ops, where you have different people who've gotten together 50, 100, 150 years ago. And while physically owning transmission or distribution lines as a person is, you know, cost prohibitive, farmers and people out in the rural areas got together and they said, hey, let's form a co-op, kind of like the REI co-op formed by a group of mountain climbers wanting to buy high quality ice picks. And so they pooled their money and got volume discounts. Same thing if you got into farmers and ranchers, landowners, et cetera, together and saying, hey, we're going to pool our resources to basically create this electric co-op where we can have electricity for our farms and our houses rather than being in the dark.
What maintenance or updates does the grid need to function optimally, in the grid speaking broadly here?
Great question. So the grid itself is actually quite well run. It is a well-oiled machine. It's the number one accomplishment of the 20th century's electrification. So what most people don't realize is that the electric grid has to be balanced like the supply and demand. So imagine a seesaw. This is the analogy I used on NPR. Imagine you have a seesaw where you have, say, Eliza, you're on one side and I'm on the other side. And since I'm a 6'4" guy, I'm a little bit taller. So I'm going to scooch a little bit closer to the fulcrum point. But the seesaw has to be balanced completely in real time. And so what happened in the Spanish grid is that seesaw got out of balance. There was a loss of generation very quickly. And so that would basically be like, if you jumped off the seesaw, then, you know, imagine it was a seesaw that wasn't just a few inches, it was, you know, 100 feet above the ground. That would have catapulted me. That's kind of how the grid is operated. It's on a second by second basis where the generation and the load must be balanced at all times. And so because of this real-time balancing, the grid has tons and tons and tons of automation involved on the generation, the transmission, the distribution. There's human operators. There's also lots of machines that automatically make sure the generation and load is balanced. The challenge is that they can only make small adjustments on the fly. And so if you have a large loss of generation, those small adjustments, although they can add up, if each generator changes its output just a little bit, that can add up quite a bit. But if you lose a large portion of the generation all at once, like Spain did, the small changes won't add up enough and you wind up with the blackout.
Now, just briefly, before we get off this issue of Spain and we talk about this sort of sudden loss, one of the things that's being discussed presently is whether or not some sort of sudden shift in the solar that was being piped into the grid had something to do with this. And let me just say, generally speaking, I think we can all agree that it'd be really great if we could rely entirely on renewables and alternative energy sources like solar. But one of the questions is, can we really do that? And what happened here? Was solar somehow maybe a little bit involved in this?
Yeah. So before we go point fingers at any one generating type, whether that's solar, nuclear, natural gas, coal, anything, backing up a little bit to how the grid operates. So when you have that seesaw, and if you have, say, loss of generation, it's like if you have several people jumping off one side of the seesaw, then that side is going to go up really quickly and it's going to catapult the people who are still on it up into the air. And the other people are going to go down really fast. So sudden changes like that don't work very well. So when we operate the grid, and this is kind of answering your previous question, you know, how do we make sure the grid is operated well? Every utility, every grid owner, operator, et cetera, they do what they call contingency analysis. It says, okay, if we lose the largest generator on the system, and so say if you're in the Western states, it's Palo Verde. So we do what's called a double Palo Verde outage. So we assume we lose the largest generator in the system, 3 gigawatts of power. How does the system respond? Can it handle that sudden loss of generation of the two, you know, largest power plants in the Western Interconnect? Or here in Texas, we lose two of our large nuclear plants. I'm just using that as an example, just because those are the largest plants. And we call that, you know, a single generator, largest single generator outage. So the problem, though, is if you have multiple generators tripping off all at the same time, tripping off meaning disconnecting from the grid, you have them all disconnecting at the same time, the grids can't handle that. You know, if one or two large ones trip off, you're fine. You know, you're fine. The grid operators and grid planners have been planning for this for decades. If you have several small units tripping offline, that's fine. But if you have, and I was looking at some articles earlier today on this, they were suspecting that up to, you know, 10,000 megawatts of solar tripped offline. The grid can't handle that. Whether it was, say, 10,000 megawatts of solar tripping offline or, say, 10,000 megawatts of nuclear, like in France, no matter what the source is, if it's nuclear, if it's coal, if it's natural gas, if it's solar, if a large amount of it trips off very quickly, the grid will have issues. Now, there's certain unique challenges that are due to wind and solar because they're not your traditional spinning generator with combustion turbine. And we can talk more about that and get into the weeds a little bit more. There are challenges that make renewable energy like solar and wind more prone to tripping offline, but they're not insurmountable at all.
You're talking about what are some of the things that make renewables somewhat challenging then in terms of keeping the grid balanced? I mean, right. They were talking about, I didn't realize that Spain gets some huge proportion of its energy from solar. Do you have any idea what it is? I thought the figure was close to 25%, and I find that hard to believe, but perhaps that's right.
So whenever you talk about the grid, this is for you or anyone, I'm not just picking on you, you have to be very, very specific of what you mean for percentages. So in the last several days, like in the spring, ERCOT, the Texas grid, had times where 70% of the grid was supplied by renewables, wind and solar. But that was for like a few hours. And then at night, when the sun went down and the wind hadn't picked up yet, it was maybe 10%. So there's installed capacity. We call it nameplate value. So like if you walk by a wind farm or whatever, you'll see on the side of the turbine, it says, this is a 2 megawatt turbine. Now that's the design capacity. It will never hit 2 megawatts ever. It never goes to 100% output. Then there's the, okay, once you put all these wind turbines in the ground or solar panels out, the sun is never shining 100% all the time. There's always some clouds somewhere. There's some dust or something's out on maintenance. What we do is we call that capacity factor, going from nameplate or installed capacity to what we can actually get out of the system. Nuclear has the highest, but it's about 85% because nuclear is down for maintenance sometimes. The problem with solar is you can pull out a number saying, oh, solar has a capacity factor of about 10%, but at night it's zero. You know, the capacity factor might be, say, 10%, but you can't just take, oh, that means we just need 10 times as much solar and we're fine. Well, no, because it doesn't shine at night. So to answer your question, you have to specify the specific duration of time that the renewable energy is supplying the load. So I was reading an article saying in the spring, the weather's nice in Spain, it can be up to 50%. In Texas, it can be up to 70%. But at 9 p.m. in the summer, when it's still 95 degrees outside, the sun is down and the wind's not blowing, it might be 5% of the grid. And that's when you need it, is those hot days when the wind's not blowing and it's, you know, still 95, 98 degrees after the sun's gone down. You know, those are the days you really need the renewables and it's out to launch.
Let's talk about the grid's role, though. We all use electricity. And as we start using AI more frequently, you know, our energy needs are just going to shoot through the roof. Now, amplify that a little bit larger. AI is going to drive a lot of our weapon systems. And that's the truth. And that's the role that it's going to play. And we've got to find the energy to do that. So let's start with just our everyday lives. Like, what role does the grid play? We've heard about a blackout, but generally speaking, what role does the grid play in sort of our needs as a household?
So this is my challenge to people. If you don't realize how much we are dependent on electricity to function as a modern society, go outside, find your breaker box, find the big switch at the top and flip it off. And then see how long you can go before you're pulling your hair out. Most people, it's not very long, right? I mean, if you have an EV, you're going to maybe last a few days before you have to charge that sucker. And you might say, oh, well, I'll just go charge down the street. Well, what happens if the entire neighborhood is off? I mean, for those who were in the Northeast in 2003, ask them what happened when they were without power for days. Or ask your friends in Texas in 2021 when they were without power for days during our big winter storm. To say that it's integral into the blood of society, modern society, is kind of an understatement.
Let's talk about what the role of the grid is in doing things like keeping the Pentagon running, air traffic control systems, messaging systems, police, fire, military messaging systems. I'm going to assume it plays a huge role in those things, right?
Oh, absolutely. What you're hitting on are what we call critical versus non-critical loads. And so before we say you're not a critical load, it doesn't mean you're not important. All electricity is important, but there's things we say critical load versus non-critical. So, you know, critical, everything you mentioned is critical load. Fire, EMS, police, hospitals. Those critical loads, there's policies, regulations in effect that say, okay, if you're a critical load, you need to have on-site backup generation for a certain amount of time. The Pentagon, I can guarantee you, has backup generators. The problem is if the grid went down for months, which the chance of that happening is really low, but let's just say, hypothetically speaking, the grid did go down for months. Do they have enough diesel fuel stored on site for months? Probably not. Now, I'm sure they have run a plan. The people that know what they're doing, who have security clearances, which I don't, have run these exercises to say, okay, what happens if the grid does go down for months? Do we have enough fuel stored? How do we get the fuel from place to place? How do we handle this? How do we handle that? And there's disaster preparedness, emergency preparedness teams that we work with that have thought this through a lot. But to say that it's important is again, a very much an understatement. The goal, of course, is that we keep the grid running 24/7 so we never have to worry about what happens if it goes down for 4 months.
Well, but you know, anything on which an entire society depends is always going to be a target of an adversary, right?
Exactly.
I mean, it's historically, I'm not great at this, but I have had guests on and I have friends who are real historians on warfare. And they say, you know, that that is a traditionally in battle, it's been a strategic choice to attack an energy source or anything that would control energy, you know, as part of an effort to subdue the enemy. So I assume that it's vulnerable and that that's been considered. Can issues or vulnerabilities from the grid be overcome by resorting to alternative energy sources like solar, nuclear, which is, you know, kind of the newest darling in Washington right now, or wind? Or are we fully dependent on the grid without those things and there's nothing we can do about it?
The answer is yes and yes. From the very beginning of the grid, ever since Edison first put in, you know, the first Pearl Street generator and ran cables down the side of, I think it was New York City or wherever he was. I'm not a super historian. As soon as he realized that, oh, wait, when the cable goes down, the, you know, the lights go out. We grid people have been working on making the grid more reliable, more affordable, and more resilient, more robust, whatever buzzwords you want to use, but we've been working on making it that way. And there's thousands of people whose jobs, whose their full-time job is to make sure the grid is run well, planned well, operated well, maintained well. Actually, I'd say there's tens of thousands of people, this is their full-time job. Some of it's thankless work, but some of it's super exciting work. If you ever know someone who works for the electric utility, tell them thank you, because they get a lot of flack for whenever the grid lights go off. It's like the lights, light and sound people at a concert or your church or whatever. Nobody thinks about them until the sound stops working. And then you're like, why is it not sound not working? Tell them thank you for keeping the lights on, you know, 24/7, basically. To answer your question, there's this discussion. What you're hitting on is the difference between decentralized and centralized generating. So small modular nuclear reactors are kind of becoming quite the buzz. And it's the idea of saying, okay, well, pretty much all nuclear power now is these giant, you know, you see the big steam cooling towers that are up and you can see them from miles away and they're kind of the iconic nuclear cooling towers. But those are massive units. They're multi-thousand megawatts. Each unit can be up to 1,000 megawatts and you have, say, 3 or 4 units. They're huge. But again, if there was a war and, you know, they're kind of a target, you can't move them. It takes a decade or more to rebuild them. You have the problem of potential fallout. I mean, if we're talking physical attack by an adversary, you know, aside from that, then you have the thought of, okay, well, what happens if every person just had, you know, solar on their roof and batteries in their garage? That would be the most secure in terms of you wouldn't have to worry about any power lines anywhere. The problem is it would become prohibitively expensive because, you know, most people would need enough batteries to store energy for days because the sun doesn't shine for days. And so it's way more expensive per cost of electricity to have solar and batteries, each person having a solar panel, each person having batteries in their garage. But there's somewhere in between is this, you know, massive decentralized power plant with big long lines taking it from wherever. Or a perfect example is wind and solar. You know, the wind blows and the sun shines out in West Texas, but few people live out in West Texas. Most people live in the central or eastern part of Texas, Houston, Dallas, Austin. So you have to have big, long transmission lines to take the power from where the sun is shining out in West Texas to where the load is. Perfect example, California. I grew up outside of the Mojave Desert, and you've just got solar farms popping up all over, you know, near Death Valley in the Mojave Desert, but you got to have long power lines to take those in, some into LA, but definitely up into the Bay Area. You know, they become single points of failure, and we have ways of dealing with that. But then we have this thing called microgrids, which there's a lot of work in the defense area of having microgrids for defense. And so if you think about it, each military base in a sense is a microgrid. You know, it's designed to operate. If power gets cut to the base, it's self-sustaining. When you look at the microgrids research, it's usually wind and solar batteries, but there is this new small modular nuclear is to say, well, okay, if I can take 1,000 or 2 kilowatts, so a couple megawatt small modular nuclear reactor, and I can put that down way in the basement under the Pentagon or whatever, now the Pentagon is self-sustaining electrically. The nice thing about these small modular reactors is, unlike the big ones, they're designed in such a way that it's all but impossible for them to melt down.
And the small modular nuclear reactors, if you're listening to this podcast and you're interested in that, you should go back about 3-4 episodes to our interview with Dr. Jeff Waxman, who is head of Project Pele out of the Pentagon. So that's interesting. And one of the things that I've noticed over the years is I live in an area where the lines never go down. We rarely lose electricity because they're buried. Mm-hmm. Do we gain anything by doing that in terms of rendering the grid more reliable or generally the flow of electricity more stable? Or does that do nothing because it's downstream?
The struggle with the electric grid is balancing costs. So we could have a gold-plated grid. Instead of having aluminum wires, we could literally bury gold in the ground and we could put all transmission lines underground and it would be the safest grid ever, but it'd be so expensive that no one would ever afford it. So it's kind of that balance between the cost of land and the cost of operating. So great examples. I was visiting DC a few weeks ago in the spring. It's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And you're right. All the power lines are underground. That's because it's so dense in there in DC. It's so population dense that in order to buy enough land to have the right of way for a power line, it's cheaper to bury it underground and use the land above to, you know, build roads, bridges, apartment complexes, whatever. But see, out in West Texas, where the land is cheap and there's nobody out there, it would be massively cost prohibitive to bury the power lines underground. So it's kind of this trade-off between cost of land, cost of operating. It costs, you know, 10 times as much to bury a power line underground. If something does go wrong with it, it's a lot harder to fix a power line underground than it is to fix one that's up in the air.
Let's move on for just a second. Obviously, businesses depend on the grids, mm-hmm. governments, military. What are the electrical aspects of nuclear power stations that might depend on the grid in order to keep a plant from melting down or having problems? Because I've come to understand, and you can expand on this a little bit, yeah. the interdependence between these systems. Yeah. We can't just suddenly disaggregate one from the other and expect to rely on it.
Correct. Some nuclear power plants have enough backup generation on site that they can operate independently from the grid and they're fine. The bigger problem is not the plants themselves. It's actually the mess that Congress has gotten us into. For 50, 60, 70 years, Congress has been promising the nuclear power plants that, oh, don't worry about your spent fuel, we'll take care of it. So for decades, the spent fuel has just been accumulating on site. They keep it in basically like a swimming pool type thing. The stuff does have to be cooled down, the spent fuel rods, because there's still some heat dissipation from these things. And so they have these cooling pumps that keep this basically swimming pool cool. And they didn't build that into the backup generation of the plant because they didn't expect to have to build these suckers. They expected the federal government to keep their word, their fault, and actually deal with the spent fuel problem. That's kind of one of the issues. And a lot of nuclear plants have dealt with this by having, you know, additional diesel generators on site, and they, you know, have a diesel storage tank. And so if something does happen, then they just have a diesel generator running and keeping the spent fuel rods cool. But things like that that weren't originally part of the design have now become a concern because we haven't found a politically acceptable solution to nuclear spent fuel. That's a whole other discussion with my nuclear engineering colleagues.
Yeah, because nobody wants it, right? It's an issue of who's going to take it, because whether it is harmful or not harmful or can be maintained or not, right? I think it's gotten to the point with all the drama over nuclear, the fear, you know, sort of the Armageddon yeah. possibility that nobody wants that stuff in their backyard. So what is the state of the grid right now in the United States? Is it modern enough? Can it really scale as we move into AI and all these additional needs? Because it seems to me, if projections are correct, that our need for energy could go up as high as 75% of what it is right now, very quickly. That's incredible. Yes. And, you know, it's a warmer year than we've ever had on record again.
Right. The answer is our grid modern? Yes. We have some legacy equipment, you know, like transmission lines will last basically, in a sense, forever if we maintain them properly. And utility companies all across the nation have been doing a phenomenal job of their maintenance. The one thing that all utility companies, of course, especially ones out in the West, need to work on more is vegetation management or tree trimming. PG&E is now paying the cost for that one with the wildfires. And as equipment gets older, it gets replaced, and there's planned maintenance, there's planned upgrades. So I would really say the issue is being generation inclusive. 10 years ago, there's this huge talk about, you know, wind and solar are the way. If we're going to have the AI revolution, we can't put all our eggs in one basket. Like, we can't just say wind and solar is the only way to go, because it's that cannot supply our needs for AI. So we're going to have to talk things like nuclear, which is back on the table. We're going to have to talk things like carbon sequestration and carbon capture. Or for my oil and gas colleagues in Texas, they would even question, do we need to go CO2 free? I mean, I won't wade into that political kerfuffle, but just instead of pointing to one generation technology and saying, this is the way, the only way, we're going to have to be more inclusive in terms of what generators we allow on the grid.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.